So in a little bit of conversation, you know, by email and so forth, the question is, what do I really have to talk about? And it turns out, you know, technical debt is a lot of that. And technical debt, at least as I coined the term, is misunderstood greatly. And I will address that at some point. But I think a bigger thing, and this is something that I notice broadly, is that it's hard to survive success. You know, that computer programmers have a tremendous power over the world. And as something you work on becomes successful, you just feel that power vanishing. And it's discouraging. So I don't know if this really applies here, but I do know that, the Wikimedia Foundation is evolving. And so I thought I ought to tell some stories about what I've seen in my career. I was a consultant for a number of years and had an opportunity to step into lots of different places and work with lots of amazing technical teams. In fact, I wanted to, just mention one was a fellow had made a lot of money and had the ability to hire a team of people to work on his stereo. And this isn't actually his stereo, but it could have been. It was a very, very complicated stereo. By stereo, hi-fi, I think we call it a media center now. And he hired a lot of technical people to work on this. And if you think about it, this is a dream job. Everybody wants to work on the best, media center ever. And, their first day, they get in there and find out just how complicated this thing has become. And then every day after that, and it took me a while to realize this, and I can't even guarantee it's true, but I believe it's true because it explains a lot of kind of strange behavior, that every day they came to work and they said, oh my God, today I'm going to get fired. I have my dream job and I'm going to get fired. And this idea of being productive, being creative in the presence of fear is something that I think is deeper. It's a quirk. It's a quirk of being an expert of something that very few people understand. So I'm gonna kind of hit a number of things. In fact, here's my one slide. So I got one slide. This is a condensation of a few things that I said I could talk about, and they said, "Well, that'd be a good abstract." And I say this is my one slide, but I will warn you that I have 40 builds in it. It's going to take a while. And the reason I'm going to leave this up there is because this is a progression of thought that will, I hope, lead to a lot of questions. And it was suggested we'll take 10 minutes and then we'll have 50 minutes of questions or something like that. And I've practiced this a few times and it's more than 10 minutes. But let's just jump into it. Probably the most important thing, I think, for working on Wikipedia is that it is so successful that there's no place to look for guidance. Eiffel Tower is pretty successful too. And, there isn't an Eiffel Tower 2.0, if there's no place to look. And so here I put the Wikipedia up on top of the Eiffel Tower as a little meatball up there. And if you're up there and you look around, you just see empty space. So now that doesn't mean that people don't come with a lot of suggestions. Oh, it ought to do this, or it ought to do that, or blah, 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 blah. And pretty soon you get this idea that you're a giant failure when you're really a giant success. So that's pretty weird. And here's my wiki sticking off the side. At least I'm off the ground. And I had a 5-year jump start as far as wikis go, and we managed to assemble up 36,000 pages. And it was an advocacy site. It was about changing the way people talk about computer programming. And in fact, we succeeded. In fact, we succeeded to the point where it actually became kind of useless. There wasn't a how we're going to talk about computer programming 2.0 to do. And so it's kind of lived its life. It a couple years ago, it went read-only and two people complained. This year, it actually went offline because my one little server couldn't handle the scrapes that were going on. And oh my gosh, you know, complaints poured in. You know, it's on Hacker News that the wiki is down. So we got that back up. But it's the funny thing is that I share some experience that you folks share. In fact, I was at an early conference and I met Jimmy Wales and we decided to go have lunch and, you know, six or eight tag-alongs. And this is the first time I'd actually met him and we're telling stories and they're all the same stories. And I say, I don't even know this guy. And he's not like me, we're very different people, but we're telling the same stories. And I say, oh, well, of course, we both ran wikis, right? You know, and so there's something about how people, oh, and hey, economists have finally caught on, you know. They say, well, first of all, it's impossible. And then the fact that it's there and they're looking it up stuff on it themselves, you know, that there's something going on. Now, the other thing I wanted to mention is, it would be irresponsible to have something as successful as Wikipedia without an organization behind it. So of course there's an organization, and that organization collects a lot of money, and I think some people here, 70% I heard, you know, are even drawing a paycheck. And so it's a really important thing that there's this encyclopedia and all the other projects. But if I say encyclopedia, I mean encyclopedia and the other projects. And then there's this organization. But organizations are a weird thing in their own right. You know, they're like alive, and if you're alive, you just don't want to be dead. So there's this preservation attitude. And it's easy to get confused if you think of them the same thing, because they're not. So I'll poke at that a little bit as we go on. But kind of working our way through what's going on here, The thing that is the fabulous accomplishment of my wiki and your wiki is that it's a place where you can be creative. You can see stuff happen there that is so far beyond what you imagined would happen that you can't help be excited. Now maybe you see some stuff going on you just wish wouldn't go on and you want to say stop it, you know, and you say, well, I'm a programmer, why don't I just program it so you can't do that? Well, of course you don't have that sort of power. You know, you have very little influence over how Wiki works. And, you know, I was a double E, so I think of everything in terms of fields, you know, but the one that helps me is to think of it as like waves, ocean waves. Think of it. Ocean waves, you know, are a thing, but they're not really a thing. It's just water. And understanding standing waves, you know, what's making them stand there? How does that work? And you have this enclosure. You know, maybe some sort of vessel or, you know, I was a water skier at one point and I remember water skiing in a lake that was in a reservoir. So it had stone walls and you do one trip around that lake and it turns into a sea of standing waves because the energy has no place to go and you can't ski there a second time around. You know, it was just really amazing. Whereas this other place I skied, you know, had reeds and shallow water and stuff like that and the waves would go in there and disappear, you know. So I think of a wiki as kind of like those stone walls, you know, they're there to hold the water, but the water's going to do what it's going to do. And that is, now if you really completely understand water, which most people don't, you know, maybe you can guess what it's going to do, but if you really, really understand people, you could guess what they're going to do too, and you'd be wrong. So, but here's a cool thing about waves that you know, you throw a rock in the pond and waves go. And if you track one of those little crests, it travels at a speed. But if you track that group of crests, it travels at half that speed. You can have the same thing going at two different velocities. Factor of two, in fact, almost exactly. And so this is a little picture of a wave at different frames of time. And that's just how weird water is. Just imagine people. So you can't... I mean, we have a lot of responsibility to make sure the system is healthy and sustainable and all this, but it's going to be what it's going to be. Now, as we start talking about the system, I said, well, You know, how can we make 1,000? How can we make 10,000 great decisions and then just end up with a mess? You know, and what do I, mess, of course, is a technical term here that means bigger than you can understand. And so here's another little mess. That's a gas turbine engine made by Siemens. That was the most complicated picture I could find that probably worked. And you know, if you hired on to work on that thing and you wanted to move one bolt, you know, 1 centimeter, you know, you'd face tremendous amount of review and so forth, and people would tell you you don't know anything about bolts, let alone gas turbine engines, and you could call that a mess, but it isn't a mess. It's you know, some of the finest engineering in the world. So this is, when you work on something that's big, this is just what it's like. You know, so now I want to go through step by step, and I hope you can read that. I'll read them for you. We're going to stack up some bricks here, and this is where I'm going to get all agile on your extreme programming. I think one of the things that we realized when computing was done on a computer on your desk with screens up there on your desk, which wasn't when I began. When I did, you punched cards and sorted them in a deck, but we could work together. We could work together. Because you and I could be sitting at the same computer, pointing at the screen, and talk about what just happened there. And when we have a conversation about what's going on in the computer, there's really three participants, you and I and the computer. And we learn a lot about what the computer wants to do together. So that's important. The work together, the conversation, so much invention is in the air between us. You know, you can't even remember, you know, who thought of it first. So what happens when you do that is the next brick there says a quality consensus. And you know, if we want to have good decisions, we have to understand what good means. Good is a hard thing to nail down in computer programming. And I know that because I read blog posts that are crazy what they think good is. But what really matters is what do you and your peers think good means? And how are we going to get something to be good enough? And this is not just spaces versus tabs. This is how you name variables, what the metaphor is behind those variables, what is the thing we're even working on today, and why is it more important than the thing we could be working on. All of that consensus, if you don't agree, then you end up tugging against each other and you're not working together. So you see, work together, quality consensus is something that you get from working together. And it lets you work together better. So they're related. So here I'm going to stack another one on here I call adaptable priorities. And, you know, having a priority one is nice because then you know what to work on. But tomorrow it could be priority three because there's another one. You know, the idea that how do you do your work when what's important keeps changing? How do you know what's important? So forth. But you can do that if you have this sense of how you do your work. You know, when you go home at night, you go to sleep and you forget what you're doing, you have to learn it again the next day. You could actually learn a different thing as long as there's this sea of practices that you know how to do. So the quality consensus and all that, it's what you do, and then what you do it to can change moment to moment. Now, in that world where you're working on two or three different things, only one at a time, but two or three different things, it's hard to have a sense of progress. How do you know that you're actually accomplishing anything? And that is even harder, especially if you're working on really hard things. That sense of progress, well, you know, again, the stack of things underneath answers that question. You know, if you and I are working on something and we finish at the end of the day, we say, well, what did we accomplish today? You know, well, we did this and that failed. We did this other thing and that failed. So there's two things that we learned today that don't work, you know, but there's a sense of covering ground. And it's hard to know that yourself. If you're always working on the most important thing and it isn't getting done, you think you're failing. But if you're working and you can have a conversation about how it's going, you know, because a lot of thought happened through the day, and to recognize that thought gives you a sense of progress. And when we talk about XP and that, you know, and especially Agile, it turned into a management thing. You know, it's more about measuring progress, and it does a lousy job. But if you have a team of people and you say, are we making any progress at all? The answer, I think, almost always is yes. So maintaining that sense of progress is important. I think there might be one more. Accumulate technique. In other words, it's okay to spend half your day figuring out how to be more effective in the other half of your day. Because it's only if you do that does the rate of progress speed up. You have to use the computer to make your work better. Don't do today's work the way you did yesterday's work. Find a better way to do today's work and share that experience. Now, if you're working together with other people, don't make it the same person all the time. You know, I'll be working with somebody I haven't worked with before, and I'll do something, they'll say, hey, wow, how did you do that? We stop and talk about how I did it. Or they'll do, more likely, they do something, I say, how did you do that? And this conversation about how to get work done is really important. This, you know, in pattern terms, we call it pattern discovery. There's an evolutionary environment. Oops, and more. You know, I sort of wear these black tags so I get lots of pictures taken. I hold my hands up here to get lots of pictures taken. But the accumulation of technique is the thing that happens that makes progress go on indefinitely. You can make progress indefinitely. And finally, I want to put up here what I call acceptable debt. In other words, for all kinds of technical reasons, sometimes political, sometimes you made promises, sometimes you just need to be done, you know, for a month and be on to something else. You get to this point where you have to say, this is good enough. This is good enough. If I come back to it a year from now, I'll be able to look at it and tell what I was thinking. And you know you could make it better, but this is, I call it acceptable debt. To distinguish it from technical debt, that means you were an idiot, you know, and you did just a bunch of junk and it just happened to work for a week and you thought you were done. That's that. Some people call that technical debt. I call that foolishness. That's like thinking you don't have to pay back your credit card, right? You know, oh, I got to buy a bunch of stuff, you know, and, you know, now there's police cars outside. You know, what's with that, right? So acceptable debt means I'm making a technical decision that this code that we've been working on together is good enough to rest for a while, and we'll be able to pick it up and do good work later when we know more about what that good work needs to be. And so that is the technical debt that is good debt, because it's built on accumulated technique so that you know how to do it, you know how to leave it in a good position, there's a sense of progress, and you know when you're stopping, you know when you're starting again, because you can feel it moving or not moving. And that means you're still in control of your debt. You're in control of what's going on. I'm going pretty long on this thing. But this is the essence of what I taught people to do, and it's all about programming. People who don't program simply can't understand this, and I don't know why they write books about Agile when they can't understand this simple thing, but they do. And if somebody's beaten you with an Agile book, you just tell them, look, Ward himself told me that this is what's important. So keep that in mind. Now, one thing that comes down to this is, like I said, you and I are programming. That third thing is the computer, and we talk computer to it. And talking computer is something you really need to know. You need to know how to talk its language, because it's not going to talk your language yet. I call that reading all the code. And there was a point where, you know, I worked on a MediaWiki site. We had 20 million pages in MediaWiki, and I learned a lot of PHP. I knew I'd done one PHP project before that, but this was big. And I want to talk about how I felt comfortable with MediaWiki. And also some crazy stuff we did. One of the most crazy things we did is we programmed in Ruby. Ruby was a new thing then, and we were going to be hip. Even though we were working on PHP, we put a little Ruby on top there, right? And then anytime we did something new, we'd just do it in Ruby and, you know, wedge that into this big body of PHP code. So here's a couple more Ruby things. And we did this after about 2 years of this. The whole thing turned upside down. Watch this. Look at that. Did you see that? That was so good, I got to do it again here. So there's some Ruby code. And then we just said, oh, let's make this be a Rails program. There it is, Rails, with little bits of PHP all over. And that just meant when it started a Rails app. And then we looked at it and we said, well, that's pretty amazing that we pulled this off at all. We really felt in control of our environment. And then we looked at it and we said, you know, that was a bit of a waste of time, too. We could have all just learned PHP, right? And that happens, but it does give me some cred for having done a massive refactoring of the MediaWiki code base. And this was a few years ago. I understand it's bigger now. But one of the things I did early on was I read the whole code base. And this isn't PHP code. This is code I was working on last week, which happens to be some event handler from Antler 4, which generates tables that can be interpreted in Java or JavaScript. This is a JavaScript something or other. It's crazy stuff. And I didn't actually use my technique that I'm going to show you, but I wanted to show you this on real code. What I do is I'll scan that, and what is the shape of that code? And this is just one function. Actually, it's one half of one function, so it's not hard to look at. But here's what I'll reduce it to. I just delete all the alphabetic characters. You know, all the new lines. And it just turns into that. Can you see that? I wish it were a little bigger, but if you just imagine all the curly brackets, all the parentheses, the equal sign, pluses and pluses. And it's especially nice because, you know, for loops. It starts out with a for loop, and it has that left paren equals semicolon less than dot, 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 semicolon plus, plus. You know, that's what every for loop looks like, right? So that it kind of stands out. And what I did is I just wrote a little script that did this to every function in MediaWiki, sorted them so that similar things were together, and made a little browsing clickable thing. I'd say, wow, that's strange. What are all those dots in a row? And I click on it, and it shows me the function. Now, here's another one, all those dots in a row. Oh, different thing, same idiom, whatever. And so I browsed all of MediaWiki by looking at these cryptic strings. And the sorting causes similar code to be similar. And I developed a sense of how it was written. I learned the idioms that were being used in MediaWiki. And my conclusion, by the way, was it's pretty good code. You know, everything in there that I saw was there for a purpose. It was carefully named. It used common. Every now and then you'll see something same, 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 almost the same. And I clicked that almost the same. Why is this one different? You know, there's a pretty good reason for it. There's something about the way errors were handled that were different or something. And so this allowed me to bring all my past experience to a code base that I didn't understand, let me browse it in a way that I could get a comprehensive knowledge. And I've done this over and over and over again. It sounds so simple. Just delete all the letters. And it leaves behind a signature. I call this the signature survey. Survey the signatures in a code base, and it works. So these last two things, you know, that stack of bricks and reading code, this is the essence to me what agile, what extreme programming is. And I do want to say one more thing and kind of move on to some other stuff. I want to say when we wrote this thing, which wasn't initially called the manifesto, but there was some arguing about who's going to own the thing, and we renamed it. But the claim we made, and this is, I don't know, 15 years ago? This was the end of a lot of period of discovery. So I think of the stuff I did was 25 years ago. But here, we were so modest. I want you to understand, we said, we are uncovering better ways of developing software. We're uncovering. We didn't even claim to be done, but we said we're discovering things. And we're discovering by doing it. We're doing the development of software. We were a bunch of software people doing software and helping others to do software. So our relationship was all about software, and we noticed it was categorically different than what we had learned. Now, one thing is computers were fabulously more powerful when this was written, and they had the graphical interfaces and you know, no punching cards or anything. It was a transformed industry, and all we were doing is noticing that, you know, in this world, there's a better way to write software. And then we noted through this work, we've come to value and named four things. And those four things have become really important. We noticed, we did a translation project, and we noticed as we got people to translate it, that they couldn't translate the four things because it doesn't actually say much. You know, they're so brief, they're so whatever they are, you look at that and you say, of course, I believe that. You know, it, and then we'd say, well, what is a software tool anyway? You know, and so people argue about all kinds of stuff. It is an emotional document and it presents something, but the most important thing is we were doing it, we were helping other people do it, and if you do that long enough, you'll develop these techniques, like I mentioned, that just make everything run big. And by the way, you know, if you're gonna fight cyber war, say, anything we suggest here doesn't help because it's a different kind of thing. We live in a different world than we did 25 years ago, so expect it to be different. And there are people who want to call that agile too, but you know, I'll disagree with them. So how am I doing time-wise? Am I using all your question time? I hope I'm answering some questions here as I go forward. I see some smiles, so it must be okay. And how many people actually live and work here in Silicon Valley? You know, so a third, maybe. And I want to just say that it's a hard place to be successful. I don't know if you feel that or not, but it is. As long as I've been in computing, I say no matter how much money I make, I know somebody makes 10 times as much. And that's pretty true for even the people who make 10 times as much. It's a strange place. It's the envy of the world, but they don't even know what they're talking about. You know, they don't even know what they're envying. Now, before I go rant on the Valley too much, I have to say that these phones are fabulous. Here's the inside of a phone. And this is not really a product of Silicon, it's a product of the world. You know, and the fact that we can make these things and make them so cheap is pretty marvelous. And that depends upon this organization of supply chains, which is marvelous. Here's a site that's a favorite of mine. It's at MIT. It's the Observatory of Economic Complexity. So what they did is they figured out how to, you know, kind of say, well, who knows what where? And in fact, they were able to project that backwards in time by looking at trade data and doing some fancy network analysis. That they even got a science paper out of just doing the, you know, can you imagine economists writing in science? But you know, I just looked this up, you know, here their most recent data is 2014, and at the top of the list, the most economically complex product that a region could have is CERMETs. And I'm thinking, I don't even know what a CERMET is, you know, but it's some sort of ceramic that is mixed with other things that make it less brittle so that it's malleable like steel but has ceramic properties. You know, I did notice when I first looked at this is there's an awful lot of chemical engineering, that the world, my tech world, lives on top of chemical engineering. And, you know, so that's what this organization gives us, the ability to have this level of specialization and depend upon each other. And it's just fabulous to see how that works. But I do want to make a different point. I want to talk about why it's so hard to live in the Valley here, or even just know people who wish they live in the Valley. And I have to make it really simple. This is some clip art I stole from Carver Mead in a recent talk. Carver Mead was a graduate student under Feynman, who liked to make things simple, and Carver likes to make things simple. So he says, well, I want to talk about gravitational waves, but let's just talk about pushing a car down the road. And what does it mean to get that car working? And allowed him to like start with some really simple formulas for momentum. I want to start even simpler. I want to talk about return on investment. Return on investment said all the time here. And it's basically the distance formula. After you throw a few logs in there or take them out, you know, distance is equal to the rate times the time. And that's, you're going to get farther if you go faster or work longer. Now, that's not what people, when they say ROI, they really mean the rate of return on investment, not the return on the investment. They're not interested in D, because they don't actually care what you make, as long as you do it really fast. And so what they do is they solve for R, the little r, what is the rate, and that's distance over time. And if you want to have a good rate, just don't waste any time. You know, just keep that time real small, because that makes the rate get big. And the people who are putting money into your business, they don't care what you do. They're not, all they want to see is a return. They want a high rate of return. And that is a meme that has spread the world over. That is a meme that was founded here in the Valley and has spread the world over, and it confuses people as to what they're actually doing. You know, if you're not getting a good rate of return, if you're not working fast enough, you're a loser. And that is so wrong that I feel I have to mention that to say that if you're doing good work, if you got measurable progress, all that stuff I put in the stack, and you have the budget to keep doing that, like maybe you work for free, that's what I do, and then it's really putting in the time. Put in the time to get good work done. And I wish I could say there was a magic thing that just gave you both a high rate of return and a high return at the same time. And maybe genius helps there, you know, but it's really no. So anytime I hear somebody talking about how we ought to do this or how would, I have to say, are they thinking rate of return or are they thinking return? And it's amazingly black and white. So, and it's not any more complicated than pushing an old car down the road. So now I want to talk about one last thing, and this is something that I get asked more and more on account of the fact that I'm getting older and older every year. And it's like, how do you stay technical? Does anybody worry about that? Think, you know, how am I going to be in this business 5 years from now? Yeah, I thought you were all pretty young. Okay. More and more, you discover that all these techniques you learn, everything you know about software, you know, any respect you get for it disappears. It disappears pretty quickly, like if not in a year, certainly in 5 years. And so you live in this world where you have to keep reinventing yourself. And I think of this in terms of patterns. I have a set of patterns, they work pretty well. Early in my career, I learned how to debug a program. And it hasn't changed much, but the programs I debug are dramatically different. And to be able to work in the current world, you really have to invest in learning those new things. In fact, I would say that if you're a curmudgeon, you know, you say, well, all this new junk is really the same stuff as I did 10 years ago. It's just that they changed all the names. And that's not true. It turns out what they did is all, it's true that all the names changed, but it's not just what they do. There's probably one new name in there for one new innovation. And if you can go find that innovation and put it to work for you, then you've mastered the new technology. And you get to bring all the rest of the patterns. You just can't call them what you used to call them, or your peers won't recognize you. But you can keep up. It is not hard to keep up, but you have to be able to let some old stuff go. So that's important. And I want to mention by pulling up a little bit of JavaScript here. This is, I spend probably half my time in JavaScript, and I want to say that JavaScript is progressing faster than anything else I've ever done in my life. And I'll say progressing, that implies, like I just said, that there's better stuff down the road and we're moving in that direction, you know, but it just does seem like a churn. And the reason I do it, first of all, I have a nice editor. This is Sublime. And I can write simpler code. This is a little parser for the markup. You see all those regexes there? That's I still write parsers by a bunch of regexes. And I get them one per line, and I can get away with that. And I love to talk about that, but that's that thing I said I wasn't going to talk about. But the other thing is, pop in here, and the debugging environment, the environmental support for JavaScript is pretty phenomenal. And you know, the fact that you can, like on anybody's computer, you can walk up and say, well, let me debug that. Pop up the debugger and say, well, this is how the computer and I talk, you know, is pretty marvelous. And so I was a small talker for 15 years, and small talk was small and beautiful. I have to say that JavaScript is huge and beautiful. You know, it's there's a lot going on there, and I like it. And I am able to do it because I was willing to set that small talk behind. So that's my story. Here's me holding my hands, posing for a picture. Click, click. Okay, you gotta be quick. What I wanna do now is, somebody help me watch the time here to make sure we finish in time. How many minutes do we have? Like zero? I don't know, I'm just gonna keep going until they throw us out. Here's my slide. I took all those little pictures and brought them forward as a reminder of the kind of things I talked about. And I would love it, I like this idea of coming up to the microphones. If you come up to the microphones and ask a question, then I can give kind of a flip answer. And if you don't like the answer, just get back in line again, come around and ask it again. Right, and so please show that all these pictures were worth the trouble, that I can remind you what they were. Is there lunch or something coming that people want to go to? Ah, very good. Now, if you ask a really stupid question, then a bunch of people will come up and ask better questions.
There you go.
Don't be too
exactly.
good. Don't be too
well,
good.
One thing, thanks for the fun talk. One thing I noticed recently talking to younger devs around Berkeley is that the tool use of graph data structures has really bumped up. And for one reason is graph has a scalable property that's useful in these times. But another reason is that the literacy where you start as like a smart high school person, the literacy level of computer science basics is so much way higher than 25 years ago, right? When I was doing C++. So that's, I'm interested in that. The graph data structure, is that, do you have something to say about that?
Oh, I probably 15 or 20 things I could say about that. I will say that I worked with a group. We hire a lot of code school people who've learned Ruby, and we're originally a Ruby shop, so that's pretty good. But I'm a fan of D3, which is a great visualization package. And a couple of them came over to me and they said, well, we want to talk about how we can do this project in the company that, you know, we're going to do it in D3. And then they kind of sheepishly said, well, we're not too good at the graph algorithms. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, you know, D3 is going to kill you. But I didn't say that. I said, oh yeah, okay, well, it'd probably be kind of like this, and was encouraging. And then I said, how about if I create some test data for you? Oh yeah, test data, that'd be great. So I wrote a little Ruby script that generated some graphs. And I made them simple and I sent them to them, and they found that really useful because they, you know, it's like test-driven development, only I'm writing the tests. It's data-driven development, and I'm making graphs that are data. And you know, then they do that, and they say, well, what about this other thing we're worried about? I said, oh, let me make some new data. And I just made the data progressively more complicated because I knew enough about the kind of graphs they were making that it would work. And that was, and somebody should be lining up over here to ask the next question, or I'm just gonna keep talking about graphs. It actually worked well because they could manage, and I think this is something you learn in code school, you manage your own learning to the point where when there's a problem in front of you that you don't understand, you go figure it out. And so I was basically presenting them a series of problems without announcing, I'm going to give you a series of problems and teach you graphs, and it worked pretty well. Over here.
You have 25 minutes.
I have 55 minutes left? 20, oh, that's perfect. I thought it, you know, the original suggestion was talk for 10 minutes, And then I made these slides, and you know, just getting through them was tough. But I love this stuff. You know, so go ahead.
This isn't directly related to anything, but I figured.
No, nothing's related here.
All right, great. I wonder how you feel about open source software in general. There's, I guess, a political aspect to it and a pragmatic aspect to it, and I don't know if you subscribe to either or both of those in terms of.
That's a very good question, because open source software is truly misunderstood.
Sorry, I was told I have to say my name. It's Yaron Koren.
Ah, nice to meet you. I was sort of, when GNU came out, I was in the Unix world, and I thought, well, that's nice, you know. But I had all the software I needed, so I just ignored it. And somewhere along the line, I ended up doing this wiki thing, and people said, oh, yeah, open source. And I said, oh, yeah, I should probably open source this. And I never really did properly license it. But some other people came along and threw something in front of it. I just looked at the licenses, and everybody said, well, read all the licenses, and it just drove me nuts reading the licenses. So that, if you think of open source as a contract with your users, you know, it's good in that regard, because you're a creator and you ought to be able to know what terms you're using. On the other hand, I think that my relationship with open source has changed dramatically with GitHub. GitHub and its commenting and pull request and all that. It basically took so much of the burden off of an open source creator. It became a place for me to work where I could work on the distance. I could go. And I've been working on a new wiki, by the way, for 5 years, and the first one took a couple weeks, and this one's not as far along, and it's 5 years, so I feel a little bad about that. So I think about this distance formula a lot. But there's a community around it, and the community is great people, and every pull request, even a drive-by pull request, oh, you did this one thing wrong with delegates. Great, so I go study delegates a while so I can understand the pull request. It puts me, because I bring something to the thing, where people will pay attention to me and talk to me. And so as a creative, I think it's a fabulous space. So open source is great. Now, one of the brilliant things that happened with MediaWiki is that it was open source, and there's a lot of copies of MediaWiki around. And I'm kind of following this thread about, you know, do we want to be a microservice architecture? And if we're designed to run on 1,000 computers, what does that do to our open source project? I think that's a serious question, although I will point out that most people who contribute are contributing because they like what you're doing, not that you're helping other people do their own wikis. But I do think that MediaWiki has benefited dramatically from being open source, and that's something you don't want to throw away carelessly. Go ahead, we'll go left here.
Hi, I'm Adam White, and I get paid by Wikimedia Foundation to do the same thing every day, and I really mean the same thing. And so a thing that's on my mind after your talk is that you have some good things to share about the fact that how you do things should evolve, and I'm wondering if you want to talk about evolving what we're doing, and maybe the frame that I think about this in is like Wikia can support, tens, hundreds of thousands of wikis of people all doing completely different things. And Wikimedia Foundation has been supporting the same subset of wikis, which is people kind of doing a rather conservative thing all the time. And wondering if that's...
Yeah, that's a good question, because, you know, if you want to do something cool, it helps to be daring. And I do bland stuff all day long, every day, and draw a salary for it. And because I didn't, God, I forgot to get rich, you know? What was I thinking? You know, so I consider myself lucky to draw a salary and the health insurance thing. But I do much more daring work in open source than I do in my day job. In fact, I often will do something at home just to see if I can do it, and after I know that I can do it, I would dare even suggest it at work. Even as CTO, I would not suggest things if I hadn't known that it would work. And so a lot of the daring work is, you know, done off production. I also think that having worked for a living and know that business wants pretty modest things from technology, that it helps to recognize the little spurts of creativity and just how you do your work or whatever, even if you don't even really believe in the big project, and I've worked on plenty that I don't believe in, you know, to find that execution can have a lot of variety, and especially if you're willing to write tools for yourself and you get good at writing tools, that's I get a lot of strength from that. But no, it's I said that technologists exist to give policymakers choices, and that means, I mean, I think of it as every single line of code is a decision made, you know, but it's a decision that, if I'm programming with somebody else, then somebody will notice. But most people don't have a clue of what I do. So I was lucky that Wiki became something. But no, most of what I do is invisible. And anybody who wasn't close to it would say it's the same old thing.
Hi, I'm Andrew. I also work at the WMF. Thank you for the talk. It's really great. One just quick comment before my question. I want to mention a saying that reminded me that your analogy about the car reminded me of. It says, we're walking slowly because we're going far.
Yes.
So yes. I'm not
sure. It's the endurance lap, you know, and for sure.
Yeah. So my question is about if you could, it's not a question, I guess, just if you want to talk a little bit about how software and computer code relates to human language and human communication, and if you had some insights onto some insights about how computer code is a form of human communication. I think that relates to Agile because a lot of the things you say in Agile it's about software development as a social activity, how people work together to develop software. And so there's a big component of that is the communication through code. And I find a lot of the time, you know, how you name a variable or even how you space the code or how you find abstractions in the code and organize it based on those abstractions is part of you communicating with other people. And there's also a whole movement of literary programming. So maybe you could talk a bit about that. Thank you very much.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I should mention that I was very strongly influenced by George Lakoff. And he and Mark Johnson wrote this book, Metaphors We Live By, and Lakoff has done a lot of other things. Very systematic study of where meaning comes from and how it's propagated. And the idea is that, you know, that you'll say one thing, but you really mean another by analogy or something, metaphorically. And that these metaphors just become part of our language. You know, there's no way to not think in terms of metaphors. And so extreme programming, which was the early and most successful agile methodology, had a practice in it called metaphor. Because I put it there. I said, look, we need to think. And I could have said storytelling. What is the story that the software tells? But it's more like, how are we going to choose to think about the things we're created? And this is an object-oriented time. We were all exploring that. What are we going to think about the objects that we name? And I said it was really important. And you might write your code, look at it, and say, well, this code turned out to be very different than what I thought we were writing. And we have to change all the names to be consistent with what it is today. And that changing the names, it means it needs to be part of a consistent metaphor about what we're really doing, because most code in the world, you know, like having input and output, you know, that just visualizes a program as a little machine and a conveyor going through it. You put some stuff in the input and it comes out the output. That's a metaphor. And how we think about code And now I would be more inclined to say story or something like that. But this idea that we might get on a wiki, and by telling stories, using terms that are defined by other wiki pages, that we might brainwash ourselves into the future by writing. And that's actually what happened. That's why my wiki became less important, because the words just entered the vocabulary. But they were all practiced by writing pages in terms of these other words. And you could just click, click, click for definition. So although people said, this whole metaphor thing, nobody understands it. Nobody's going to do it. Nobody's going to sit down and think of what the metaphor they're using for a program. But they did it all the time on Wiki. And so, it's caught on in a weird sense. Just like all the pattern stuff, nobody goes and reads the pattern book anymore. But if you listen to anybody talk, they're just citing patterns left and right because they learn the words.
So we have about 15 minutes. In addition to these four people, I have at least one more question coming from IRC.
Let's take IRC first. Can we sneak in there? Because I'm not sure we get to everybody here, and somebody's got to watch the clock carefully.
Okay, so I'm literally reading here. So someone said, we are walking slowly because we are going far. Question, can you talk a little bit about how software and computer code relates to human language? And can you share some insights about how computer code relates to communication? That relates to Agile because it's about software dev as a social activity. So there's a big component of that is communication through.
Okay, I think I heard two questions there. I'm going to go for the other one. And instead of talking about metaphor, I just want to talk about what it takes to read code. And one of the things you're diving into if you just commit yourself to reading a lot of code is, it's like, even if it's in a language, a computer language it's just completely foreign because you're hearing a different voice or a different set of voices. So when I jumped into MediaWiki, I felt like I was in a conversation that was going on without me. And what I had to do is I had to read enough of it so that I found how these people talk. And it's very technical, it's precise. It's like people say, mathematics is the language of science, and so they use the word language there correctly, I believe. There are some people who say Morse code is the language of telegraphy, and I learned it well enough that I hear words instead of letters. That's pretty cool. But to look at a lot of code and see thought, to see the product of a human mind on the page, and then imagine what that human mind went through to produce that, is something that, you might say, my friends would have done it differently, and that's judgmental. But if you want to say, I just want to see what people were thinking when they wrote this code, and if they were careful enough to make what they were thinking manifest, I think it's a joy. I wish I spoke more than English, but I don't. But I speak lots of computer languages, and I've looked at this point, I'll say lots of different dialects of JavaScript, for example. They're getting too much time over there, but they've got a longer line.
Hi, my name is Derkin Hartman, and I'm a volunteer developer. Let me reword my question a bit based on the last question. If we are speaking about the language and the vocabulary and things like this, looking at how we now have wikis, and they're mostly targeting prose and text, I mean, that's where it came from mostly. What do you think the lessons are in terms of technology if we want to take this to new forms of storytelling or whatever with new media types and other directions that authorship can go to? What can we learn from what we've learned from Wiki and Markdown and these things?
Well, I think one thing we've learned is that natural language typed in on a typewriter is actually pretty amazing what you can do with that. So don't ever leave that behind. But I worked briefly for a company that was going to invent user-generated content videos. And I learned a lot about videos, and I learned how hard it was. One of the pleasures of that. I was actually working in Venice Beach when Andrew Lee was down there in Venice Beach, and we spent a lot of time talking about that. And he turned me in, you know, he, of course, he's a video zealot, turned me on to lots of things that are sort of formulaic about making good video. I remember the BBC Five Shot was an example that he had done, a great little video about how to use that as a set of patterns that will guide you to making acceptable video on pretty much any newsy subject. And so that, I think, is important. Of course, video storytelling is really hard. I saw that Andrew had something out. He says, well, maybe these kind of year-end montages are the sort of thing that video would really work for. And he did a couple, which I watched before coming here. And I say, hey, wait, great work, you know, because I saw, you know, 2016 was a great year for Wikipedia, watching Andrew's video. I think VR is a different challenge. I think VR has the opportunity. Every VR I've seen is just a bunch of, you know, random things thrown into a room with a checkerboard floor or something like that. But it seems to accept random things. I mean, it might be possible to lay out an organization like this space and say, well, let's just make an exhibit space, and here's a bunch of exhibits. There was a great video, what was it called? It's called Monday Morning or something. It was a Will Vinton video that was basically that. It's claymation, you know, guy in a museum where all the exhibits were just dynamic. It was great. But the challenge is that the production of video, and I assume the production of VR, maybe visualizations are a little better. It's hard to imagine how that's done collaboratively. Of course, I was told when we started with Agile, it says, no, you can't develop a program collaboratively because you don't know who to blame, you know? And blaming was so important. And they'd be on Wiki collaborating where nobody owned anything, explaining why you can't possibly develop a computer program with collaborative ownership. And they were collaborating, you know, it was the weirdest thing. But no, I think as we get more and more developed media that has a process of production, that we have to invent new processes that are amenable to collaboration. And I think it will be a new art forms. And it'll be hard to make, you know, that the technology, and people will come and tell you how to do it. But you know, Andrew had a lot of neat tips, and so he's a good guy. Don't let him get away. All right, this time you have to come up with a question cool. Now.
Yeah, a bit related to a question. I was wondering, we'd like to share some things you learned from your work in recent years on the Federated Wiki.
Yes.
And to give a better background, so my name is Tim Ambire. I work for the foundation too. I'm also a long-time Wikipedia editor. I remember your keynote for Wikimedia 2005, with I think was related a bit that Daniel mentioned.
Yep.
And over the last few years, I've kept this list on my user page. It's called a timeline of distributed Wikipedia proposals. It's like all the time.
Oh, that's a great page. I know that page.
Okay, cool. Yeah, just to tell everybody, it's all the times where somebody thought, hey, we have these linear revision histories. It would be great if it could be more like GitHub. We could fork and merge articles, and it's been proposed so many times, it never actually succeeded. I'm kind of wondering if it's because it's technically difficult, because it maybe actually ignores some of the things that made Wikipedia successful. Anyway, I was just wondering if you could share some things from Federated Wiki, which might be especially interesting for Wikipedia.
So I mentioned, I didn't call it Federated Wiki, I don't think, in 2005, but I said, I see a future where servers are gonna talk to each other, and I'll have my own server, and they'll enter the conversation. And every morning, I'll come on and see what my server has found for me. That was my vision, and that this was more personal than the conversation that we have on Wikipedia, where you know we have to agree before the edits stick. You know that there could be disagreement, and there would be a pressure for them to be resolved, but that it wouldn't be as excruciating a pressure. I was dreaming about this and mentioned it, and I was told that it actually stirred up a lot of conversation. But 5 years ago, I had the chance to spend a year among a number of things developing this, and I was quite surprised that it didn't turn out to be a server-to-server thing. It was a browser-to-browser thing, where I could be in a browser and I could reach out to a bunch of different wikis and pull the pages together and expect them to form a story that maybe has never been told before, especially if it included some calculation, because there's JavaScript in there and it can calculate or visualize or whatever, that it was a new medium for a new style of collaboration. And I am more convinced that that's important, maybe not for encyclopedias, but as a way that we in the world can talk to each other than ever. What I have learned is that nobody wants to work that hard. You know, they like pushing the like button. You know, just let me just say if I like it and move on. You know, that we're not even really a culture of reader, we're a culture of viewers. You know, oh, I like that picture. You know, you had a nice breakfast yesterday, and like. And that is pulling the level at which we have conversation as a people way down because it makes people money. And so Federated Wiki, I'm content to work on it. I've discovered a handful of things. We've grown to, you know, about 1,000 sites that, you know, and I would say that on any given day, if 5 of those sites have edits, that's a good day. It really depends upon who is promoting it, and I promote developer to developer. If anybody wants to succeed with Federated Wiki and has developer talent, then I want to work with them. But I'm not the community advocate. Community advocates have to come and bring their own community and have a technical person to talk to me too. And that you know is something I could get away with. People come along and say, oh, well, you know, if you just put a Facebook button down at the bottom, you get so many tweets. You know, I said, well, you know, if I was judging myself by how many tweets I got, you don't get tweets in Facebook, whatever you get. and this is more of that R, little r versus big D in the distance formula. Now, I also know that a lot of great work was done a few centuries ago, and the people who did the work never got to see its appreciation. If it turned out to be that, well, you know, maybe we'll have some conversations here. I'm here all week, and we can talk about that and what I've learned from it in depth. But I think it is, although we share the W and the I and the K and the I, it's a very different thing and intentionally different. Not enough to talk about it, but it's you guys have your leadership in a direction that I admire, and I'm happy to learn what you're doing, and love that I had a chance to participate. And maybe that we'll have to call that the last question. Do we finish up here?
So we have a hard stop in 5 minutes.
And there's hard stop, and we're up to the hard stop then.
And there's 3 people with questions. I don't know.
Okay, no more people come stand up, but those who are already standing will do your
no
question.
More questions.
Thank
from
you.
IRC?
Thank you for the great questions, by the way.
I have one here.
Oh, one. Okay, another IRC question.
Yeah. Earlier you said Wikipedia has nowhere to look for guidance, which can be problematic. At the same time, wikis are losing editors, and one of the potential places they are going to are social networks. Do you think wikis should try and unincorporate social networking features? Bonus, or should wikis be social networks?
Should wikis be social networks?
4 minutes.
No, I'd say absolutely not. I'd say that's absolutely the wrong direction. And one reason I put you up on top of that, you know, because, you know, I don't care how much money they're making. It's down there. It's television. And that's not to say there isn't good television, you know, and some of it comes from San Francisco, but it's a much more nobler thing than that. Now, does that mean that it can go forward without changing? Of course not. And that's where this whole how do you get the waves to do what you want them to do? And the answer is you can't. But you can make changes and you can observe it. And I don't actually follow most of the conversations out of the foundation, but I do read the research list, and I like the research list because they're saying true things about what people do. It's like, here's the physics of water, only it's talking about people. I also want to say that having read it for a number of years, I'm convinced they're just barely scratching the surface. There is so much to know about what people do that is not known through that research. The nice thing about it is it's repeatable, and I really appreciate the people who produce the feeds, and anybody comes and asks some crazy question and they treat them very nicely. That is really great work. And that's more likely to expose something. If you're talking to people who really live and work as editors, and then you have some stats that are probably true, and you reconcile those, and if that gives you a hint, that's much more likely to be valuable guidance. And you know, over there at Facebook, they're studying this stuff like crazy to figure out what they can get you to do, too. They're studying themselves to figure out what they can do. You guys have to study yourselves, and the fact that you're open and there's so many people willing to help, that's a position of strength that very few people have. So that's the answer.
Last question. And quick answer.
Hi, my name's Matt Herbst, and I discovered the C2 Wiki back when I was a teenager 2 decades ago, and it blew my mind, taught me to love Camel Case and people patterns and projects.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that you brought it back up, because I saw it was down earlier this year. Been recommending it to everybody. But I was curious about you. You mentioned that for the last 5 years, you've had a new Wiki software platform that you're developing, other than WikiWikiWeb. Was this the Federated Wiki?
It is the Federated Wiki, yes.
Okay, so that's well.
And one thing I did is, you know, about year three, first of all, I expected Wiki to last 6 months, and the fact that it actually worked at all and people treated it with such respect was amazing. And then we actually covered ground. We accomplished our advocacy goal. We changed the way people talked about computer programming. That was pretty neat. And then, you know, we got the sock puppet thing, and it was popular enough, it scored very well in Google, that it attracted riffraff, and the community was willing to fight it off. And I didn't give much help because I was the only programmer. And I just said, look, when these guys start launching robots at each other, that's the end. And then it happened a couple years ago. Some guy got on there and started fighting with the old timers and said, no, you're doing Wiki wrong and whatever. And people tried to help him, and he was abusive. And then he started publishing scripts. He says, here, look, here's a script that'll delete all of this, and here's a script that'll delete all of that. And I said, no, we're not going to run those scripts. And I went read only, and 2 complaints, right? So it's like it had lost its value because it was fixed in its goal and it met it. Now, then I'm thinking, well, I want to make this thing where we can talk, where we don't have to be so narrow, you know, that we can talk broadly, you know, about how we're going to live on the earth. You know, it's not a scientific question. It's like, how are we going to share resources when they're in short supply? That kind of question. And I fed the original Wiki into that. So it's in there. But if you want to write, you have to put up a server to write on. And you know, so people who don't even want to construct sentences, the last thing they want to do is put up a server. And my hope is that, you know, this is, you know, with Docker or something, it's going to become much easier. But it's right now, it's you have to type npm install -g wiki, and you got it.
Ward, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the chance of speaking to you, and I hope that there's been something in all this that's very useful. I'm around for a long time, and I'm proud of you.